Hi, this is Richard Gage, AIA, with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and you are listening to No Lies Radio.
Show here on NoLiesRadio.org. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, and every week we do try to bring you the best guests with the most important things to say that aren't being sufficiently attended to in the corporate-controlled mainstream media, and that goes double for today. The broadcast today, September 11th, 2012, is on the 11th anniversary of 9/11, and Lord knows the corporate-controlled mainstream media isn't telling us the important things we need to know about that event. So that's what we're here for at No Lies Radio and the other great alternative media outlets out there. My own favorites include Veterans Today and Press TV, as well as my own TruthJihad.com. Well, today we're going to be talking about an event that may be breathing some fresh life into the 9/11 truth movement. Today, September 11th, 2012, is the release date for the great new fictional film, Operation Terror. The word fictional should maybe be in quotation marks, because I think if you watch Operation Terror and then you sit down and read the 9/11 Commission report, you're going to find that this film, be it a Hollywood thriller, is far more accurate in its depiction of the events of 9/11 than the supposedly authoritative Commission's report. It's a really interesting mixture of fact, and you know, it is full of documented facts, very, very disturbing facts, and then some speculation about how to connect the dots between those facts, and it's very well-founded speculation. So this is a really good film to show your neighbors and friends who are maybe not quite ready to go there with the full 9/11 truth thing, but who are willing to sit down and watch an entertaining thriller. And halfway through, they may kind of wake up and say, uh-oh, you know, I think I read something about one of these things in the paper, and then start researching it, and who knows what might happen next. So not only is it a very well-made fictional thriller, but it's also a great avenue to 9/11 truth. And if it picks up steam and starts snowballing, who knows, it could be a really big motivational force in the truth movement. So with me to speak about Operation Terror is the writer and producer, Art Olivier. He is kind of the Jesse Ventura of California. He used to be the mayor of Bellflower, just like Jesse was the mayor of a suburb of Minneapolis. And he ran for governor, just like Jesse Ventura did. The only difference was that Jesse Ventura is the great, big, strong, muscle-bound guy, and so he was able to body slam his opponents, while unfortunately Art was up against another great, big, strong guy, except in this case one without much brains. What's that governor's name? Schwarzenegger or something like that. And unfortunately Art got body slammed, even though he was by far the best candidate. Art has also run, he's run for VP against Dick Cheney. He's a Libertarian Party star. And I think Operation Terror, in with any luck, is going to be putting him on the map in the truth movement in the near future. So, hey, congratulations on putting out Operation Terror. Art Olivier, thank you so much for this great film.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Hey, but by the way, I could take on Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's not a problem.
You know, I'd be happy to be your tag team partner there, although probably Jesse Ventura would be better.
In that election, Arnold was very afraid of me. He actually had a person that went around to every one of my events, got half of them canceled. So he was very concerned about me running against him. But he also kept me out of the debates too. They wanted me in the debate, and his people said no. If Olivier shows up, Arnold will not. So.
Really. Wow, yeah. You know, it's amazing how paranoid some of these people have become about somebody succeeding outside of the two-party duopoly. You know, when Jesse Ventura actually somehow won that three-way election in Minnesota, just barely, you know, he kind of got 34% to 33% each for the two other guys, the Republican and the Democrat. First thing that happened when he was sworn in is he was marched down to a sub-basement room by a bunch of CIA agents disguised as Minnesota state government employees. They sat him down, and they grilled him, interrogated him, everything but waterboarded him to find out how the heck he got elected so they could make sure it never happened again. So apparently, you know, success outside of the two-party duopoly is very scary to certain powers that be.
Right, right. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with the fact that they made sure that my events were canceled and that Arnold wouldn't go anywhere near where I was at. So,
yeah, you know, and that's pretty telling. You know, if they really didn't care about you and didn't see you as a serious threat, they wouldn't bother to do that. So they must
right,
have been
yeah, because,
afraid that, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because at the time, you know, I had more government experience than Arnold did. He had been governor for 3 years. I had been on the city council and mayor for 5. I had done all the things that Republicans claim that they do, such as cutting taxes and privatizing services and going out for competitive bids and, you know, doing all the things that, you know, that the Republican Party claims to do. And whereas, you know, he had spent his first 3 years going nuts on his spending. So, yeah, they made sure that the majority of people didn't know that they had an option.
Kind of reminds me of what the Republicans did at the convention to Ron Paul. They didn't want people to know that there was the Ron Paul option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
What do you think about Ron Paul? I know there's a lot of buzz right now that he might announce a third-party candidacy on Jay Leno tonight. You think that's a possibility?
No, it's not possible because the Libertarians have already selected their candidate, and to get on the ballot in this short amount of time is not only unlikely and very expensive, but probably for most states it's not even possible.
Okay, and just to clarify for the listeners, we're actually recording this a week ahead of September 11th. Which is, you know, if there's a glitch, if Ron Paul has somehow already become a third-party candidate or somehow ruled himself out, that's why. So, yeah.
We
need options, though. And at this point, like, you know, Roseanne Barr and Cindy Sheehan look pretty good to me, compared to the other guys, anyway. Who do you think the Libertarians, what are they doing up to this year?
Yeah, it's Gary Johnson, two-term governor of
Johnson,
New Mexico.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great candidate, and Judge Gray, I know him personally, and he's great also. He's the VP candidate this time. But, yeah, Gary Johnson, he vetoed more spending bills than all of the other governors in America combined. I mean, he really is a – he always has – even though he ran as a Republican for governor, he he's always been a small L libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Now, is he willing to stand up to the military-industrial complex mafia? Because, you know, I've noticed that some of these guys who used to be sort of small-spending libertarians come into the Libertarian Party, and it turns out that they're maybe, you know, not willing to go up against the big guys.
Yeah, we had a big disappointment back in 2008. But, Gary Johnson wants to immediately pull the troops out of Afghanistan and South Korea and Japan and Germany and everywhere. Yeah, he wants to drastically reduce the size of the military industrial complex.
Right, and that's, of course, the Ron Paul position that is one of the reasons that Ron Paul has built up that huge movement. And if he did run as an independent, of course, it would have been smarter to sort of plan that long ago. Obviously, he could have a huge impact. Probably Obama would still win, but projections are that Ron Paul can take away, you know, two Republicans per Democrat from the big parties. And if he could just up that to sort of two and two, you know, it really is not that inconceivable that at some point a third-party candidate is going to actually win the presidency. Perot came so close, and, you know, then they reacted against that, shut third-party guys out of debates and everything. But anyway, how long do you think it'll be before this two-party duopoly finally collapses?
Well, I mean, I've been in politics for a long time. I like, you know, the people go out and vote for who they think is the best candidate and everything. But really, when you get to that kind of a level, if voting made a difference, it would be illegal. So
yeah. Well, it sure is getting that way. In fact, it may have been that way for a long time. You know, we've had a bunch of phonies, especially running for president. But you know, even for the other national offices, it seems that they pretty much pick and choose their people who are corrupt or corruptible. So I guess the best way to do politics is through educating people, and that's what your film Operation Terror does. You know, I've made this point to libertarians many times, and some have gotten it and some haven't, that 9/11 is the ultimate anti-government soundbite, the ultimate anti-government commercial. You know, when you find out that it was your own government that was complicit in blowing up the trade towers and murdering 3,000 of your fellow citizens, it just completely blows away the whole worship of government that is this country's real, you know, nationalistic faith, as David Ray Griffin put it. You think the Libertarian Party is going to capitalize on this before 9/11 becomes an ancient historical memory?
I don't know. But yeah, you're right. You know, the people that follow history, they knew that the Lusitania was a setup. They knew that the Lusitania was shipping weapons over to Great Britain before World War One. Before America got involved in World War One, you know, they knew that, but back then it was a conspiracy theory because it couldn't be proved. You know, it was like 80 years later, the divers went down there, looked in the hull of the Lusitania, and lo and behold, it was full of weapons. You know, so it takes a lot of these conspiracies generations to be uncovered. But yeah, here we got this opportunity with 9/11. We know it now. We've got the videos, we've got the eyewitnesses, the photographs, the scientific evidence. We've got everything here in place right now. All we got to do is present it to the people. It's not going to take generations for people to figure this out.
And I think it's a real festering wound in the body politic, and a whole lot of the increased skepticism and cynicism towards government that we're seeing today is a sort of either direct or indirect outgrowth of the knowledge that 9/11 was an inside job. You know, the polls show that maybe one out of five Americans firmly believes it. As many as 36% in one poll say it's either likely or very likely that it was a false flag op designed to trigger the wars. So that's a lot of Americans. 36%, that's over 100 million people. And, you know, there's no way that knowledge of this, you know, incredibly hideous kind of thing can't be sort of poisoning the whole public opinion, you know. It's doing its work subliminally, and I just kind of wonder at what point, you know, the dominoes are going to fall.
Well, I think it may take another false flag operation for the people really to rise up and revolt. But the more people that understand what happened on 9/11, the less likely it is that we will have another false flag. And if it does happen, then the more likely that people will rise up and overthrow the powers that cause these false flags.
And the great thing about it is that a lot of military people are actually pretty patriotic and, you know, think that they're supposed to be doing their job the way the Constitution says. You know, and of course they are part of a swindle. You know, our military is not really defending our country. It's out there running roughshod over the world. But even so, most folks who sign up for the military are not exactly eager to run around doing false flags, you know, blowing up American buildings and killing thousands of innocent American civilians. And a lot of them are very annoyed about 9/11. I just did an interview with Gwyneth Todd, who is a pretty high-level person in, you know, both the Clinton and the Bush administrations. And I think she figured out that 9/11 wasn't what they were telling her. And her job was ostensibly to keep the admirals who were running the Fifth Fleet over in Bahrain informed about the geopolitics of the region. But what she ended up doing, and what became her sort of unofficial job description, was stopping the neocons from staging a false flag event to trigger U.S. war with Iran. And she did that for years, right up through 2007, when kind of she did it for the last time and actually stopped a planned false flag, a big one, you know, after the brass had been purged of the good guys and they were all set to go for Cheney's big war on Iran in 2007. And then she, you know, blows the whistle on it to the State Department. And the next thing you know, she's on the run for her life. And so she's been hiding out in Australia ever since. But there's an example of a patriotic American in government service who, thanks to waking up to these things, takes action.
Yeah, and I think they're afraid of a lot of the people that are in the military. You see it now with people that are coming back that are just getting out of the military. They're being sentenced to detainment, going to a mental facility, and if they say that 9/11 was an inside job, and you know, so you got them afraid of our own military. But the problem is I think they're bringing in a lot of foreign troops. You know, they back in 2008 they already signed an agreement with Canada to bring in Canadian troops into the United States in case of civil unrest. And they're looking at maybe having that same agreement with some other countries. So it's not just the American troops that we have to worry about, because I think there's a lot of, you know, a good percentage that are not going to, you know, that will be on our side, but we have to worry about the foreign troops also.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, just the thought of Canadian troops invading and occupying the U.S. sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit or something.
Right.
The only way it would ever happen, of course, would be, go ahead.
when you read the Council on Foreign Relations pamphlet, it's called Building a North American Community. They had talked about having this relationship with Canada, with the militaries, and they said they also want to have one with Mexico. So that is already being planned to have Mexican troops working side by side with our own or even on their own here inside of on U.S. soil.
What an amazing scenario. Imagine that. Civil unrest breaks out in the U.S. as the middle class tries to defend its existence, and the elite brings in crack troops from both Canada and Mexico, carves the U.S. into a couple of occupation zones. Sounds like science fiction, but the way things are going, who knows?
Yeah, and the Mexicans are taught from a very early age that this is Mexico. They're taught the whole southwest of the United States is Mexico. I even found that out when I spoke at University of Davis. I was debating the Green Party candidate for governor, and he stood up and he slammed put his fist on the table and he says, "This is Mexico!" And about three quarters of the people in the audience stood up and cheered. You know, so they're taught that this is Mexico, and if they come in here, all they're doing is defending their homeland, and I don't think they'll have a problem with shooting Americans.
Interesting. A lot of futurists have suggested that the immigration from Mexico into the part of the U.S. that used to be Mexico could present a big long-term problem and a potential geopolitical conflict. And you know, various commentators who were willing to be a little bit incorrect, politically incorrect, like Pat Buchanan, who's come on my show, and others have suggested that you know, we really should be maybe slowing down this immigration wave and thinking about, you know, what kind of political future we want for that part of the country. I know you're one of the libertarians who does not favor open borders and total free immigration. And how have you debated this with other libertarians?
Oh, a little bit. Mostly it was with the Green Party candidate for governor. I just think they're getting set up. I mean, right now you see the new program from the Obama administration to allow the illegals that are here, that are under the age of 31, to get a two-year work permit. Well, what's going to happen after that 2 years? They're filling out 12 pages of information that they're giving to the federal government. These are people that are here illegally, and they're getting a two-year work permit. I just think they're getting set up, and I think after that, the 2 years, they could be rounded up and deported. You know, and you can imagine, some of these kids can't even speak Spanish, and they get deported to Mexico. That is going to create a huge amount of civil unrest. So, you know, it could be that we're looking towards engineered race riots in a couple of years.
Really? So you're thinking that they might let the people work for 2 years and then suddenly round them all up?
That's all they get. They get a two-year work permit, and they got 12 pages of information on these people. So, yeah, I think they might be getting set up on this.
I wonder if a lot of folks are skeptical about that, and if there are quite a few people who are not applying for this amnesty or this work permit.
Well, yeah, I heard there is, but there's also lines going around the block trying to get one.
Interesting. Well, you know, people tend to trust government probably a lot more than they should, which brings us back to the issue of 9/11 and the film Operation Terror. Apparently, you've had a hard time getting this into theaters, which somehow doesn't surprise me. It's very slick. I think it may be the best, the most well-made of the films about 9/11. There have been a number of fictional films with the 9/11 truth subplot, and I think this may be the best. At what point, you know, are we going to be able to get this to a mass audience? What kind of roadblocks have you faced getting it into theaters, and how can we get around that?
Well, my publicist has been in contact with just almost every distributor in Hollywood, and now there's nobody wants to touch it.
Yeah, boy, you know, it's too bad Aaron Russo passed away. There's a guy who would have been a great Hollywood ally for this kind of thing.
Yeah, Aaron's a friend of mine. He's a great director, and I don't know. I even doubt if Aaron could have got it into the theaters.
Yeah. Well, I guess once he came out exposing the Rockefellers as 9/11 conspirators, that probably would shut down certain avenues for him.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens when you work on trying to get this distributed? Do you have anybody come right out and tell you that, well, this is, we can't do a 9/11 truth, even a thriller?
No, I haven't. Nobody's admitted that. I think privately people have told, you know, people have told my publicists that, you know, this is not something that they're going to be able to do. But officially, no one says that they can't do it because of the subject matter.
You know, and I think the whole attitude just really shows you that people deep down inside suspect or know that it's an inside job. You know, if this were just some goofy conspiracy theory and people didn't believe it, you know, thought that it was totally laughable and mentally had completely dismissed it, they would have no problem with a fictional film about it. You know, we have fictional films about all kinds of nefarious things. And I think the reason that everybody is so afraid of it, they can't even come right out and tell you that the reason they can't get it put in the theater is because it's a 9/11 truth film, is that deep down inside, everybody knows that either it's, you know, they either know it's true or they know it's likely to be true. That's why it's so darn terrifying. That's why they're all paralyzed.
Yeah, but then again, a lot of movies don't make it to the theaters. You know, the biggest majority of movies never even get finished. this one got finished because it was self-funded, but I would say probably just one out of five movies that start production ever actually get finished.
That's right. And I heard somewhere that, you know, maybe 1 in 100 or even 1 in 1,000 scripts ever becomes a movie. The scriptwriters
right.
mostly live on selling scripts that never get made.
Right, right. I made sure that the money was there up front, that I had the money to finish the project, so we were able to do it.
And apparently your budget was incredibly low. This is a really polished, beautifully done film with good special effects. It looks like it cost millions, and your budget was only around, what, $100,000?
Well, you see, that's the trick that they play in Hollywood. Yeah, my movie was $100,000, but what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to add a zero to that, you know, because that's what everybody does. So if you spend $100,000, it's really, you know, you tell them it's $1 million. If you spend $1 million, it's $10 million, you know. So, when you compare my movie with another movie, you have to really compare it with a movie that costs $1 million because, you know, because everybody exaggerates. But even then, it probably looks better than just a $1 million movie because of all the hard work that we put into it. Paul Cross, the director, you know, he worked really hard and for very little money. The actors that we had, we probably spent 2 months screening all the actors, and I think we went through about 1,000 different actors, and we ended up with 75 paid actors and about another 50 extras, and they all worked for $75 a day. The locations were kind of expensive because I got some really great locations throughout the movie, so that cost a lot of money, and a lot of the editing, you know, was expensive. But the fact that I, you know, did a lot of the work myself saved a lot of money.
How did you run into Paul Cross? He does a terrific job here, and I guess he made another 9/11 film as well, didn't he?
Right, and that's how I did it. Yeah, he had a movie. It was about the attack on the Pentagon. And I watched that movie, and I thought he did a great job directing that movie. So I set up a meeting with us, and he was all gung-ho about directing this one also. Yeah, it was called Severe Visibility.
Severe Visibility. You know, I haven't seen that one yet. I look forward to it. Someday there's going to have to be a real, you know, comprehensive 9/11 truth film festival, with sort of, you know, everything that's ever been done, ranging from, you know, the loose change type documentaries to these fictional films. It'd be a lot of fun. Maybe we could do that in, you know, Tehran or Istanbul or someplace like that, where they're open to the thought.
yeah, that'd be great. Apparently they have I guess it's today, 9/11, they're having a film festival, a 9/11 film festival in Oakland. But I didn't know about it. Yeah.
Well, you're premiering this film in L.A., right?
Right, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to be at the Rave Cinema tonight, and it's at the Promenade at the Howard Hughes Center. It's right off the 405, just north of the Los Angeles Airport.
Okay, September 11th, 2012. Don't miss that. And then there's that film festival in Oakland, and there's one in New York as well. That's part of the events, the 11th anniversary events in New York that I'm out here for. So, you know, I think that has been probably the biggest single way of spreading 9/11 truth. I'm sure more people got the idea for 9/11 truth, or, you know, first heard of it through Loose Change probably more than any other single source.
Right, right. Yeah, and I've screened it to people that that would never sit down and watch a documentary in their life. And they enjoy it. They think it's, you know, it's a great, exciting movie, even though they don't understand that a lot of those things that in the movie really happened. Yeah.
Right. Which adds a whole new dimension to it. You know, and that's
right.
Actually kind of cool. You know, I like movies like that where, you know, you watch it on the surface and it's a really good movie, very engrossing. And then you learn all sorts of actual, you know, factual things, and it becomes an even better movie. And that's exactly how
right.
it works.
Yeah, and I have those 75 paid actors that I have in the movie. Very few of them knew anything about 9/11 before the movie started, but doing the research on their own characters, they discovered what really went on, and I would say probably close to 90% of them are truthers now.
Cool. Well, I hope some of them have joined actors and artists for 9/11 Truth. Have you looked for them there?
No, I haven't. I haven't done that, no.
Yeah, you know, it'd be kind of cool if you could, you and the whole cast there could sort of, you know, descend in mass as members of actors and artists.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, sure, why not? I mean, it's, you know, these professional groups have been a big force. You know, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is the best known, but Pilots for 9/11 Truth and all sorts of others, the scholars, the firefighters, the religious leaders, the what else?
I'm a member of the Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth.
There you go. Political Leaders, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so these groups are doing good work, and it's good to support them. And yeah, the more, you know, it's kind of a snowball effect. You know, the more people glom on, the faster new people glom on. I understand some of the sort of, shall we call them the timid people or the anal retentive people in the Truth Movement question your film because maybe you don't show 9/11 happening exactly the way they think it happened, or maybe they think that you're showing things that haven't been absolutely verified. We don't know with 100% certainty that this or that is what actually happened.
I actually haven't heard any of that personally. No, I mean, I've been to several We Are Change meetings, and I've never heard any of that from anybody. A lot of the extras I have in the movie are members of We Are Change in Orange County and Los Angeles County.
Oh, great. Okay, shout out to We Are Change here. That's another great group. I guess I just got this secondhand from Alan of No Lies Radio, who knows all these people in the Bay Area. And the 9/11 Truth community in the Bay Area has been disturbed by naysayers more than I think any other 9/11 Truth community in the world. There's a whole sort of contingent of troublemakers out there, and they're always sniping at anything good that happens in the Truth Movement. And so Alan just mentioned that there were a couple of the usual suspects complaining that your fictional film, which is, as you say, 50% fact and 50% well-founded speculation, is not 100% fact. But, of course, then it would be a documentary, not a fictional film, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are things that that you and I will never know about 9/11, and you have to speculate, and you have to try to put the pieces together to make a feature film.
Yeah, obviously. So for your well-founded speculation, let's say one of the items is, you know, people wonder how the fake, you know, hijacked planes into buildings thing was accomplished, and you've gone with what's kind of the most obvious and most plausible hypothesis, which is remote-controlled planes.
Right, and the way that the reason why I came to that, you know, scenario in the movie is when I was researching the passengers, I started finding all these passengers that work for aerospace companies. I used to work for Boeing and McDonnell Douglas myself, and so I know a little bit about this. And I would say that many, if not most, of the 9/11 passengers on those airplanes worked in defense-related jobs. And a lot of these guys were working on the Predator program, where they were making remote-controlled planes. And there were people working for the Defense Authorization. There's a guy that was working for the Naval Weapons Station in Maryland, where they probably produced the nanothermite. You had it was four guys from Raytheon that were avionics engineers. You had five people that worked for the company that audits Raytheon were passengers. You had people that made the testing equipment for avionics that were on the airplanes, propulsion engineers from Boeing. It just goes on and on with all these people that that had the ability to make remote-controlled airplanes to hit the building.
And you said about 50%?
I would say, so I read somebody that's been doing some research on this that they say as many as 75% of the passengers had defense-related jobs. I haven't done an account of it myself, but yeah, I would say many, if not most, had defense-related jobs.
Wow.
And, you know,
what are
the
odds?
Right, right. I mean, you go on an airplane of 200 people, you know, you might be able to find a couple of people on there that have a suspense-related job, but, you know, not half of them.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, these flights were, you know, not only that, but they were underbooked, insanely underbooked. I believe that, you know, if you added up all of the passengers on all four flights, I think it gives you somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, 250 or something, and, you know, giving you an average of something like, what, 75 or 60 to 75, something like that per plane, which is less than a third full, the average of all these planes. And, you know, they ranged from less than a quarter full to maybe a third full, which is highly unusual. Obviously, most planes don't run around less than half full, you know, much.
Right, right. I think on that day, I think that the planes were averaging, I don't know, 85 to 90% full. There was very,
right.
very few planes that only were a quarter full.
Right.
And,
so
and probably only four of them.
Right.
Probably only four that day.
Right. The only
because,
four
you know,
that were less, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fuel is very expensive. That's the biggest expense on running an airline. And you just can't pay for the fuel if you're only a quarter full to go from Boston to L.A.
Right, right. So what are the odds that, you know, on a day when all the other planes are 85, 90% full, the only four that are a little over a quarter full on the average have 75% military contractor employees on board. Come on. I mean, that means that the non-military contractor employees are a pretty minuscule minority there.
I hope it doesn't get like that.
Yeah. I mean, just you know, running the math on that makes it pretty obvious.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at the odds on everything else, too. The fact that every time that we have a plane crash in the United States, first thing they do is they gather up all the serial number time change parts. You know, when we build an airplane, you have parts that have to be changed out at a certain time interval. And they all have serial numbers. So when a plane crashes, that's what you look for. You look for those parts with the serial numbers on them. You know, and a lot of those parts are made out of titanium or stainless steel. And in every plane crash, those parts are recovered. But except for four crashes, which all happened on 9/11. Those are the only four aircraft I know in modern history where the time change parts were not found. And they weren't found on any of them.
That's right. And we've had high-level military people actually speak out about this, saying that that's why they decided it must be an inside job, is that not a single identifiable part from any of these four aircraft that allegedly crashed that day has ever been produced. And that just seems beyond bizarre. Even the black boxes are highly dubious. I guess they claim they found black boxes for the Shanksville and Pentagon planes, but they claim that the New York planes somehow disappeared and the black boxes vaporized or something and were never recovered, although there are people who say that they were there when black boxes were found in the rubble of the Trade Center. It's all a bit confusing, but one thing that's not confusing is that we can be 100% sure that what they're telling us is not the truth.
Right, right.
And so when you went with the remote hijacking angle, you're kind of going up against the big Hollywood blockbuster Flight 93, which really bothers me. You know, I'm a Muslim. I've been a Muslim since 1993, and I really don't appreciate this endless wave of media propaganda making Muslims out to be a bunch of, you know, suicidal, homicidal lunatics, you know, who just love to, like, smash planes into buildings and stuff. You know, the only reason people believe this insane scenario of, like, four successful suicide pilots is that they dehumanize Muslims. They imagine Muslims to be something other than ordinary human beings, because we know that ordinary human beings like us would be very unlikely to be suicide pilots like that. But those Muslims, those crazy, bizarre subhumans, would clearly do something like that. And this was used to, you know, drive home the official story and to create sort of a wall of racism around the concept of Muslim. And it's this notion of what happened on the planes that gives everybody nightmares about Muslims.
Well, you know, they have to do that with anybody they want to go to war with. People didn't, before World War I, nobody really disliked the Germans. but you have to have a big wave of propaganda to get people to dislike the Germans so we can go to war with them. And it's the same thing with every ethnicity that we've ever been to war with. You know, you remember the Maine, Lusitania, the Mato. I mean, we always have to demonize the people that who are going to be our enemy. And so that was a very important part of 9/11 to be able to go in and take over Afghanistan and Iraq and overthrow Libya, and now we're into Syria and put the drones out on Yemen. People, you know, a lot of people will say, hey, those Muslims have it coming. So it's very important to demonize our future enemies.
Right. Well, what's kind of interesting, though, is that we've been in an age of, you know, warfare of nation states, and in some ways warfare of entire peoples, which is very different from what was happening, you know, before the 19th century. You know, in the 18th century, it was the kings that went to war with other kings, and nobody really cared which king won, and they hardly had any tax revenue to fight with. But since then, we've come into this era of wars of whole peoples, doing total war against each other. But it's always been nation states. You know, we haven't had religious wars since the wars of religion of the, 16th century. And those were these horrible wars driven by religious fanaticism that ravaged Europe. And it was revulsion against these wars of religion that created the Enlightenment and modern European secular culture. And now here we are going back to this idea of wars of religion by demonizing Muslims, a religion with 1.5 billion, maybe 2 billion members around the world. And I think that's very dangerous. And it's all concentrated, of course, in occupied Palestine, where there's a genocide going on. And the greatest Islamic religious monument on earth, which, you know, the architectural monument, the Masjid al-Aqsa, has come into play. And it's, you know, sort of being slated for some kind of demolition. And, you know, the wacko fundamentalist Jews and Christians want to rebuild their temple and start slaughtering purple heifers or whatever it is they want to do there. It's all, you know, whipping people up into kind of a religious frenzy of irrational hatred and bloodlust. So I think it's even worse that they're, you know, demonizing Muslims, or, you know, it'd be like demonizing members of any religious faith, but especially a really big one like that, is extremely dangerous. It's one step beyond demonizing nationalities in terms of its, you know, over-the-top, you know, absurdity and potential for disaster.
Yeah, but I think we're even more than demonizing the Muslims now. I think we're, instead of a war on Muslims so much, it's a war on terror, because terror has, you can't ever have an end to the war on terror, because you can call anybody a terrorist. And, I mean, they're even calling people like myself terrorists now, you know, where libertarians are terrorists. People that supported Ron Paul are terrorists. You know, I'm sure 9/11 truthers are considered terrorists. So it's a never-ending war to grow the police state.
Right. And if you really break it down and analyze how this works, it seems that the concept of a war on terror is, what it's doing is it's sort of really brainwashing people by saying that, you know, the state is the only source of legitimate violence, and that therefore anybody who opposes the state and its leaders is kind of threatening some kind of illegitimate violence, which is, you know, how they're trying to define terrorism. And, you know, therefore we must give more money and power to the state to stamp out anybody who doesn't like it, support it, or agree with it. And, of course, libertarian theory would tell us that this is very nefarious, to say the least.
Right. Right, yeah. And the very beginning of my movie, I have the guy that's going to be, he is writing the script, basically, of what's going on in this Operation Terror, you know, in a terror attack. And he quotes, I think it's a Goring, about how the way you get people to support a war is you just pretend like you're being attacked. And people,
you denounce people for a lack of patriotism if they don't support the government in retaliating against the people that have attacked you.
Because
they did the same thing, you know. Yeah, they did the same thing in Nazi Germany, you know, with the Reichstag fire. I mean, that was a false flag and got people to rally behind Hitler.
Right. And your film, when it starts that way, I guess it's the head of the council is briefing a CIA guy on this plot, this 9/11 plot. And the head of the council, it kind of reminds me of the National Security Council. And, you know, I just interviewed somebody who worked with Richard Clark, Richard Clark has a very interesting history. He was busted for spying for Israel, which meant that they fired him for a job that required approval for Congress. I forget what it was, because he was busted for spying for Israel. And he was, but because he's untouchable, so I'm told, he was then kicked upstairs and given a job on the National Security Council, where there is no congressional oversight. I was told this by Gwyneth Todd, who worked beside Richard Clark for years and years throughout the Clinton administration, and then she came back into the Bush administration. And basically she, you know, confirmed without coming right out and, you know, accusing anybody that the most, you know, obvious suspect for the kind of hands-on overseer and designer of 9/11 is Richard Clark. And so he was on the National Security Council, and then he became the terror czar under both administrations. And it's interesting that you kind of have this guy, the head of the council, you know, being the one who's handing down the orders.
Yeah, yeah. Here, I could play something for your listeners here of that that scene when we have the council meeting, the head of the council meeting the CIA agents to be in charge. I'll play that for you, okay?
Sounds good.
$50 billion of oil in the Caspian Sea. I can't get it out.
Sir?
And we defeated Saddam, and now the Europeans are getting the oil. Now have a seat, Alan. All these red dots, oil fields over which we do not have control. Now that has to change if we intend to continue as the world's superpower. We have a military that is greater than the rest of the world combined. If we continue to allow these petty dictators to determine who will control their oil, we need to use our military might to take that oil. America's grand strategy should aim to preserve and extend our military advantage as far into the future as possible. The problem is the pacifist mindset of the American people. To break them up, we need a catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor.
You mean like what the Bureau tried to do in 93 to the World Trade Center?
So that did not work out so well. We can't rely on amateurs to provide desires. That is where you come in. Very impressed by your operations in Pakistan?
Yeah, so a lot of that scene there was from writings in the PNAC, Partnership of a New American Century. That's where I got a lot of the material for that scene.
Right, right. And it also kind of echoes some lines that Brzezinski included in his book, The Grand Chessboard, where he said that, you know, the majority of the American people would not have supported involvement in World War II if it hadn't been for the shock effect of Pearl Harbor, that Americans, and even more than most nationalities, are averse to getting into wars, and they need to be shocked and brainwashed into it. So, yeah, it's kind of a neat line that kind of combines PNAC with Brzezinski very concisely.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. And then later in the movie we have Dick Cheney complaining about Perrin, the lead CIA agent, and the same guy just really puts Dick Cheney in his place, you know, to show who has the power. You know, he goes, come on, Dick, because you were the director of the council, you know how we operate. And really put put Dick Cheney in his place and dismissed him out of his office. So
well, that's an impressive admission by itself, watching Dick Cheney get put in his place.
Yeah.
Well, Cheney, it's interesting. Some people in the 9/11 Truth Movement sort of follow David Ray Griffin and looking at Cheney as really a key player and a kingpin. And then others, like Webster Tarpley, beg to differ and think that Cheney was probably not at the top or even close to it. Interestingly, Tarpley does kind of finger Richard Clark as a prime suspect, just as Gwyneth Todd, who worked next to Richard Clark all those years, apparently does. But anyway, just watching Cheney get shot down is nice because he's so obnoxious. I mean, we kind of want to blame 9/11 on him just because he's such a slime ball. You know, he looks perfect for the part. You should have signed him up.
Yeah.
You should have recruited him to act in the film, do a cameo.
Yeah, no, I have a really great actor, though, that plays Dick Cheney, and he did a really great job.
Oh, so that wasn't Cheney.
Oh, yeah.
And you treat Able Danger as well. Able Danger being that U.S. Army program of trying to pinpoint terrorist threats. And, of course, they come across these 9/11 patsies, Muhammad Atta and so on, and they're ordered to cover up the faces with little yellow stickies and forget they ever saw these people. And then you include this scene, which I hadn't even really heard about, or if I'd heard about it, I'd somehow forgotten it. Where
not too many people know about the Ryan Scientific Systems, and it was a company that had been hired by the Army to do data mining, and they were just coming up with all sorts of information that they would get from different news sources and the internet, and come up with this huge chart which I reproduced. That shows Muhammad Atta and Osama bin Laden and all these other terrorist patsies and how they're all connected with each other. And then they had this one part of the chart that was called the Brooklyn Cell, and that had a lot of the patsies that were involved with 9/11 on it. So they got raided, according to the guy that ran the company. They're unfortunately out of business now, and probably has something to do with this, but they got raided by a bunch of guys in black, I don't know, what would you call it, fatigues that came in and took all of their men in black. Yeah. But these weren't like black suits. These were, you know, with bulletproof vests and automatic weapons and everything. Came in and raided their office and took all of their charts, all their computers, their plotter, everything that they had that was related to Able Danger. And it just so happened that some guy still had a chart out in the trunk of his car, so it was able to be, you know, reproduced, but even that was destroyed a few years later.
That's just amazing. And, you know, you'd think in that situation they could sue. Was there ever a lawsuit around this?
Not that I know of. They were probably
paid off. When your life gets threatened, maybe that slows down your your urge to sue.
Right, right. Yeah. Apparently, they were threatened with being charged with treason if they talked about the raid. So I'm sure that they had something to do with it. But they were probably paid off. Almost everybody was paid off after 9/11.
You know, Yeah, I hear rumors that there were a lot of payoffs, and also a lot of people got killed.
Right, yeah. Susan Lindauer talks about her CIA handler who got a $13 million payoff after 9/11.
Yeah.
And it seems like it doesn't even seem like he was directly involved. I mean, he knew about it, but it didn't seem like he was directly involved with it. So, yeah, I'm sure there were a lot of huge payoffs after that.
It's funny, you know, they give Richard Fuse Susan Lindauer, CIA handler, $13 million to build a mansion to keep him quiet. And I've been yapping about 9/11 for almost 10 years now, and nobody's given me any million-dollar mansion to try and shut me up. Hint, hint. Yeah.
They probably know it doesn't do any good for people like you and I.
Yeah, I just don't know how to keep my mouth shut. With something like this, I don't see how people can keep their mouths shut. My God, it's It's treason of the most ugly variety. I don't know how these people live with themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when I was the mayor. I mean, there's all sorts of corruption at every level of government, and very few times people would try to bribe me because they knew better.
Right.
So when you don't go and bribe an ethical person, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I guess they have sort of a way of sniffing out the ethical people. It seems like the psychopaths may be better at detecting the normals than the normals are at detecting the psychopaths.
Being in politics, you get a pretty good nose for the psychopaths.
Right. They seem to gravitate to that profession. So since you're having a tough time trying to get this great film into theaters, I guess you're selling DVDs. How can people get a hold of a DVD?
Well, you go to OperationTerror.com. You can buy it directly off the website. We're just actually selling them today. Today's the first day that they're going to be released, and so you can go on there and get your own copy of the DVD.
Well, you can be the first in line for Operation Terror on its release date. Okay, and again, that website is?
OperationTerror.com.
OperationTerror.com. All right. Yeah, that's one you'll definitely want to own. Probably a collector's item someday. And it's definitely one to think about showing to your friends. And
it also makes a great Christmas gift. Think of all your friends and family that you can buy this movie, and you can go to the website, pay for it yourself, and we'll ship it directly to the people you want to send it to. So.
I can just see your mom is going to get this, under the Christmas tree, and she's going to say, "Well, it's not another of your conspiracy movies, is it?" And you say, "No, no, Mom, it's a great thriller. You'll love it."
That's it.
Yeah, it'll work for everybody. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, I mean, even the packaging, looks just like a Hollywood movie. It doesn't look like a documentary cover or anything like that.
Yeah, it looks like a Hollywood movie, it walks like a Hollywood movie, it talks like a Hollywood movie, and it's got a 9/11 truth theme. It's just what the doctor ordered. We need to get it out there. So can 9/11 truth groups organize showings of this in their communities? Do they have the right to just, do that, or should they contact you first?
Yeah, it is copyrighted, protected, but what we like to do is, we allow them to show it. We'll give them a Blu-ray. We'll give them the artwork for the posters and postcards and everything else. We just require that they sell a certain number of DVDs.
Great. And so how should people contact you through the website, OperationTerror.com, to ask about that?
Right. Yeah, they would get a hold of my publicist, which is publicist@OperationTerror.com. And that's on the website, too.
Publicist@OperationTerror.com. Sounds like a plan. I think that multiple showings of this on campuses and, your local, wherever you are, even just inviting people over to your house for popcorn, giving away free popcorn and, advertise it, or go to the local library. You usually get screening rooms in the library. This is a great way to get the word out and to have some fun and, not sit down and take it when they overthrow our government, murder 3,000 people, and think they can just get away with it forever. Well, I think we've used up the hour. Thank you, Art Olivier. It's been great. Appreciate your excellent work with Operation Terror, and congratulations on getting it out on September the 11th, the 11th anniversary of this infamous act of treason.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Okay. Take care, Art.
All right.
That's Art Olivier. He's the former vice presidential candidate for president, as well as a candidate for governor of California. And he's the writer and producer of Operation Terror, which is now on sale at OperationTerror.com. Its release date is today, September 11th, 2012. What better way to mark that very important date than by getting a copy of this, the best yet fictional depiction of 9/11 in the form of a Hollywood-style thriller. I'm Kevin Barrett. This is The Kevin Barrett Show on No Lies Radio. See you next week here. And in the interim, over on the Evil Rival Network, to find out more, just go to truthjihadradio.com. www.blogspot.com. Till the next show, have a good one.
And most people think you're a nut.
Element out there that believes the U.S. government orchestrated 9/11, that is President Bush and the American military killed 3,000 people. One of those pushing this theory is Kevin Barrett, who actually taught at the University of Wisconsin this fall.
I don't think this is the proper forum, though, for people that hold extremist views like yourself. Reason
no, you guys are extremists. Fox News is the biggest bunch of extremists on the planet.
Typical people see you as an extremist, and I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to teach that class. My
I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to be on the airwaves spewing your venom throughout this country. I think you guys should be taken off the airwaves because you
are silence the conservative.
I'm not even a teacher. I'm not even a teacher.